The reality is that we've got two members of the serving government, whatever colour is a party they come from, whatever you want to call them, who have been very vocal about being anti-business.
That was Scottish Conservative MSP Jamie Green, and we will hear more from them later in the show. Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode I'll be joined by Rachel Emery, David Clegg and Andy Phillip to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read to you by Derek Healy.
Nicola Sturgeon is being urged to give Scots a clear message that it's safe to go back to the workplace as part of efforts to boost the country's economy. Business leaders at CBI Scotland have set out a series of concrete policy recommendations for the First Minister, who's due to announce her programme for government next week. But as well as putting in place measures to improve skills and invest in the green economy, Ms Sturgeon has been told that to build confidence in the post-pandemic recovery, Scots should be given the green light to start returning to the office. Scotland's councils have drawn up plans to welcome hundreds of Afghan refugees over the coming months. Under current proposals, at least 60 families and a further 73 individuals have either arrived or are expected in Scotland. It comes as part of a resettlement programme for people who worked with the British military or government in Afghanistan. 4 million doses of the Pfizer jab will be sent from the UK to Australia as part of a COVID-19 vaccine deal. The Department of Health and Social Care has confirmed Australia will return the same overall volume of doses before the end of the year. The first batch of 292,000 doses is due to be shipped out shortly.
Thank you, Derek. Okay, so we got back to Holyrood this week with MSPs returning after the summer recess. We caught up with Scottish Conservative MSP Jamie Green to see if it really was a short, sharp shock return to politics as normal.
What a week, eh? First week back, and I guess it's a different place for two reasons. One is we had an election before the summer, lots of new faces, half of them I don't recognise. Every time somebody stands up to ask a question, I have to look at my screen to see who it is and what their name is. I've never seen them before. But also because of COVID restrictions, a lot of us have been working from home, or a lot of our staff have been working from home, and we've never really seen the chamber so busy. There's still a few restrictions on the numbers, but it's nice to see people back. It's nice to get colleagues back, and it's nice to socialise, even if it is 2 metre distance in the queue for a coffee in the garden lobby. But it really feels like Parliament's back up and running properly instead of on Zoom.
Oh, I saw Douglas Ross on Zoom this week, and he had chickens in the background, which is like my favourite thing. We need more farmyard noises in
politics.
There's
no chickens in my house. Live and things. Absolutely no chickens in my house. I do have a noisy dog, so if you do hear some barking, I apologise.
And likewise as well. So, you're the Shadow Justice Secretary. What does that role mean to you?
All right. So, following the my re-election, it's my second term now back in Holyrood. Previously, I had served in a number of shadow portfolio roles in the shadow cabinet, namely transport and infrastructure, and then education during COVID. In fact, most of it was education. But Douglas had a reshuffle and has appointed me as the shadow cabinet secretary for justice. So I will be shadowing the current Scottish cabinet secretary for justice, who is Keith Brown, who is, you know, is an MSP colleague who I've known for a number of years through different portfolios and committees, etc. So, I mean, really, I'll be focusing on shadowing not just what he does, but what the government is doing in terms of its programme for government, in terms of its delivering on its manifesto commitments, and also putting pressure on the government in ways that I think the justice system in Scotland and the judiciary should be going. It's a really wide and varied portfolio. It's been absolutely fascinating so far. It covers everything from policing to fire and rescue services, prisons, and of course the criminal and civil justice systems as well. And we all know about some of the problems that currently exist in that, and hopefully we can go into some of those during our chat.
Well, we had unveiled this week the new government programme. Now that we've got the Greens in partnership with the SNP, your party's been calling the Greens extremists. Do you think they're extremists, Jamie? Or does that word overplay it for you?
I don't think so. I mean, what is this all about? Nicola Sturgeon is pretending it's not a coalition. It's some form of partnership. But the reality is that the two co-leaders of its party are sitting in government. They're sitting around the table with Nicola Sturgeon, with SNP ministers and cabinet secretaries. They now have access to the full gamut of the civil service.
Well, why is that a bad thing? Why is that a problem? Lots of countries have coalitions. Conservatives went into coalition for 5 years with the Liberal Democrats in the UK.
We did, but the Liberal Democrats weren't trying to shut down our economy and ruin the Northeast and oil industry. They weren't anti-business, and they weren't taking us in a bizarre and extreme direction politically. I think many people, including many members of the SNP themselves, are quite concerned about this coalition. And let's call it what it is. It is a coalition.
I think that's fine to call it a coalition. I think you're getting lost in the word here.
I think the problem is that Nicola Sturgeon wants the best of both worlds in this. And the reason she doesn't want to call it a coalition is because that lets the Greens... It gives them a little bit of an out when they come to disagreements and some of the issues that they might face. I mean, the reality is that we've got two members of the serving government, whatever colours or party they come from, wherever you want to call them, who have been very vocal about being anti-business. And I think pose a serious threat to Scotland's economic recovery. So I don't think that there should be a place for them in government. Also, if the SNP had been absolutely clear, crystal clear with the electorate before they went into the election, saying, look, if we don't get our majority again, if we lose that majority, as we did in the last election, then we are very likely to go into a coalition with our nationalist friends, the Green Party. But let's call it what it is. It's all about ensuring that the SNP government will be able to pass vital and key votes on the issue that matters to them, and that's the issue of independence. And it's nothing.
Isn't that the business of any government to make sure that they can pass legislation that's important to them?
Well, indeed. It's a shame, though, that legislation is about referendums and independence and not about recovery from COVID, not about the economy, not about sticking up for our oil and gas sector, of which, let's bear in mind, was a huge part of the SNP's own papers on independence. You know, Scotland was going to thrive on oil and gas money in this magical independent country. Well, I wonder what Patrick Harvey has to say about that.
At least the Greens seem to have a really thought out plan for transition towards more green energy jobs. That's something that's been criticism leveled at your party, that you are against any end to oil and gas production, but you don't really have a cohesive plan that would see that transition happen for the workers in the Northeast.
Well, I would respectfully refer you back to our manifesto. It had very detailed plans about the circular economy, about biodiversity, about how we improve working practices in agriculture. I would argue, in fact, when we blind tested that manifesto, it came out very highly amongst the electorate in terms of its credentials in green policy.
So you'll be happy that we've now got a minister dedicated to circular economy with Lorna Green then.
Yeah, but it's a shame that's
Lorna Slater. I call her Lorna Green all the time.
Yeah, Lorna Green. Jamie Green. We're not related. I think that would be true, and it would be welcome if it wasn't someone who had so overtly said that they want to shut that industry down. That's not a just transition. That's not a plan. That's not a policy. That's not going to keep people in jobs. That's simply an ideological position that says oil is bad and those jobs must go. That's not a plan. I don't see a genuine just transition anywhere in the Green Party's manifesto. And I worry that that will form part of this partnership and this new approach of the SNP government, which, to be fair, has been criticised heavily by business all throughout the COVID pandemic as being an anti-business party in government. And I think I genuinely am concerned, and I'm not the only person. You know, we've seen people like Jim Sillars today in the newspapers saying that the Greens are going to drag the SNP so far to the left that they'll just lose the plot.
Well, my takeaway is, as a quite impartial outside observer, the more that you guys send out, the Conservatives send out press releases criticising the Greens and the SNP, the more worried I perceive that you're getting. You're quite clearly rattled by this coalition.
You're right. We should be worried. I think the whole country should be worried because, you know, this SNP Green coalition is bad news for Scotland. It's bad news for our recovery. And all it does is hand power to a minority party in the parliament who have been basically bought off with the promise of ministerial posts in return for endless and undeniable support for pretty much everything the government does.
Isn't that what happened with the Conservative and Liberal Democrats, or the Conservatives of the DUP? They were bought off with 100 million to support Boris Johnson's hard Brexit, weren't they?
Well,
isn't that what coalition deals are all about? Giving people something that they want in return for their support? Your party's no stranger to that.
And we're no stranger to coalitions, absolutely. I mean, I some of my colleagues hark back fondly to the days of Dave and Nick standing at the doors of Number 10, and many people feel
I don't think anybody in the Liberal Democrats harks back fondly and Nick standing at Number 10.
Clearly, they've paid the price for that coalition, but there's no denying that. But I think in that instance, what many people thought is that what the Liberal Democrats brought to the table was a calming influence to some of the policies that the government of the day had at the time. Also, the Westminster system is completely different. They had to form a coalition to make a government, to go to the Queen and ask to be a government. The big difference here is we already had a government. Up until the summer, up until this week, there already was a Scottish government which commanded, to be fair, the support of Parliament and a First Minister who was agreed by Parliament that she would be the First Minister. They didn't need to do this deal. What they have discovered, though, is that when it will come to those key votes on matters such as another referendum on independence, they would not pass that without that undying love from the Green Party. And that's really what this is all about.
Well, I mean, the Greens are pro-independence. They would be supporting another independence referendum, whether they're in government or not.
So therefore, the question is to the SNP, why did they not explicitly tell people that if we lose our majority at the election, then we will form a pro-independent nationalist coalition with the Green Party? That was never on the paper.
Jamie, last time we talked, it was a few months ago, it was just before the election, We talked about civility in politics. And as now, we had a very polite discussion. One of your colleagues this week, Tess White, accused Nicola Sturgeon of fomenting anti-English sentiment. Do you think that helps the cause of civility in Parliament?
Well, I was sitting at the back of the chamber during FMQs today when that comment was made. I didn't hear it myself. I only heard the response from the First Minister. My understanding... what time is it now? Half three. About an hour ago, Tess said that she was sorry for the comment, withdrew it 100% and has absolutely apologised, not just to the Chamber, but I think personally to the First Minister, which I think is the right thing to do. And I think she's dealt with that appropriately. She admits that she crossed the line with that. I think to answer your wider question, though, and I've only been in politics 5 years, but and don't get me wrong, I've been on the receiving end of endless amounts and torrents of abuse, especially online. I do think there is an onus on all of us across the political spectrum to try and improve not just our working practices in Parliament, how we debate legislation, but also how we treat each other as individuals. Some of my best friends are in the SNP, in the Labour Party. Goodness, I think I've even got a Lib Dem friend, but don't tell anyone. And we get on and we debate civilly. We do it in the pub. We do it over dinner. I think we could probably do more of it in Parliament as well. But the problem is it's a two-way game and it requires everyone to make that extra effort. I certainly will play my part. We've all learned lessons. You know, you get into politics and sometimes you make mistakes and you learn from them. We've all done that. And I'd be the first to admit that. And I'm willing to say that, you know, we all have to put our neck on the block here and say we will try and make civil society a better place. But that requires a top-down approach as well. And that also requires the First Minister and her government and her backbenchers to take a lead on that as well. And I listened this week to the Parliament of endless amounts of grievance, anti-UK sentiment emanating in the questions, in the debates, and in the comments being made by the centre benches, by the governing benches. So they have to do their bit too.
Jamie Green, Conservative MSP, Shadow Justice Secretary, thank you so much for being with us today on the Stooshy.
Thank you.
Thank you, David and Jamie. Right, let's turn our attention to what has been happening. This week, MSPs returned back to Parliament after a summer recess. Andy and Rachel, you have been covering that for this week, and it's safe to say, let's start with FMQs, which it was the end of the week, but probably caused the biggest stir, or the biggest stooshy, if you will. Andy, talk us through what Tess White did. She's appeared multiple times in the paper for good and bad reasons.
First Minister's Questions was always going to be an interesting one, because it was the first time that we've seen her flanked by her new Green ministerial colleagues, that all eyes were on how this would go. It's been a long summer. We've had an election. Basically, an entire new government has been created. But it was what was said off mic that really started to catch people's attention. I mean, Tess White, North East MSP, had already asked a good searching question about something that we've been reporting a lot on recently, which is long ambulance waits. The pressure on the NHS is well known during the pandemic. And then it got more and more heated as the session went on. I don't know if they were just a little bit overexcited to be heckling from the backbenches again and trying to sort of lay down a few markers. But Tess went a little bit over the score, and it was during a sensitive answer to do with anti-Irish racism, sectarianism, shameful scenes that we saw last weekend in Glasgow, people chanting hateful abuse in the street. Midway through her answer, talking about how welcoming Nicola Sturgeon thinks Scotland is, up popped Tess White saying, unless you're English. This wasn't immediately picked up by everyone on the microphones and the speakers in the broadcast, but it was quite clearly heard by everybody around her, and there was an almighty uproar. And we all found out exactly who was speaking and what was said, and it's fair to say that there was a fairly chastened statement of apology to the chamber and through our emails later on that day, as she realised that she had indeed probably just stepped over the mark a little bit there. Nicola Sturgeon was furious.
She was raging, wasn't she? I mean, that's what caught the attention. You and I were both watching it.
Aye.
And I couldn't hear it, and I rewound it and paused it and shouted at Hans at my computer as much as I could, but we couldn't pick it up. But it clearly irked her. And it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there are elements in the... I'm going to be careful here, choose my words very carefully, but you know, there are elements in any nationalist movement that suggest that some people should get out. And we have had some Tory councillors and some other unionists upset the language used around about the UK and the union by some members of the SNP and other in the Yes movement. You know, it's... What am I trying to say without putting my foot in it here?
Well, think about the protests at the border on the A1.
Exactly.
Scotland and England.
Yeah, look what happened in the summer last year. You know, and there was the sign saying English out, wasn't there?
England out of, get out of, sorry, Scotland, England, yeah. Was one of the things which was supposed to be a political point about where you think the government's attentions lie. I mean, it was already a fairly incendiary thing to say or put on a banner. But... you know, it quite clearly it rubs a lot of people up the wrong way, and Tess White kind of took that and ran with it. But I mean, to say it like that during an attempt to address sectarianism in Scotland was, you know, it fell well wide of the mark, and it was quite clear that she was a bit chastened by it and did apologise.
If I could just jump in for a moment, I think one of the, I wasn't in Parliament for this, obviously. I just caught up with it subsequently, but I think one of the reasons why Nicola Sturgeon was probably so agitated by that remark is exactly because of what you're laying out, Paul, which is the SNP historically have had an element of their support with those types of views. There's the Settler Watch group, which had anti-English tendencies and rhetoric, and caused some problems, and they were expelled from the party. And I think the SNP in recent years, under Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, have done a brilliant job, really, of positioning the party as this kind of all-embracing, progressive, welcoming face of nationalism that stands aside or against the kind of perhaps anti-immigrant rhetoric or feelings that you would get from... an element of the Brexit support, for example, in England. So the SNP, I think, particularly the leadership of the SNP now, are really, really sensitive about that. So to be accused of that is almost one of her big, big pressure points, because she has made such a part of her steering of the SNP to try and not only drain any of that poison, but also to position the party as very much against that, and to be a welcoming, progressive form of nationalism. So I suspect that's because it was a visceral reaction from the First Minister, wasn't it, to the comment?
Yeah.
We see what you're saying there about nationalism as well. She's publicly talked about how uneasy she feels about that label in the past, and if she could do it all over again, she might not have national, you know, in the name of her own party and other movements where nationalism is their driving force. Come with a lot of unwanted baggage, and she's tried very hard to make her a completely different form of nationalism. So yeah, it's a it's a total fault line, a pressure point, as you said.
And Rachel, do you think there's a lot of criticism for the Scottish Conservatives in the way that they've behaved in Parliament recently, especially under Douglas Ross, with sort of the more personal attacks that they seem to be producing in Holyrood? Do you think this is an example of them just almost shooting themselves in the foot, get a bit carried away with themselves, and it's a bit playground? Do you think this will play out badly for them?
You have seen certainly in recent weeks of Parliament, it has become a little bit more uncivil, if you will. There has certainly been more personal jibes and opposition to every party across the board, really. And one thing that Nicola Sturgeon was saying when she announced the Green deal was hopefully this will bring more cohesion between everybody and bring in more civility. But as soon as that was said, both sides, all parties sort of went back to that nipping at each other and personal attacks on each other. So yeah, it's something that is sort of creeping more and more and more into Holyrood at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of the language, especially around the Greens, I still shudder when I hear the word extremist used about an MSP, especially if it's someone like Patrick Carvey or Lorna Slater. I know that the Tories are raising very valid points regarding oil and gas and the transition, but I think extremist, you know, especially in the wake of what's happening in Afghanistan, does seem to be a bit weird. We've started to see the reality of that SNP Green Deal come. I don't think the Greens themselves were probably expecting just quite so quickly to go out to bat for Nicola Sturgeon. Andy, we saw yesterday in an interview Patrick Carvey defending vaccine passports when he'd of course said earlier in the term that he would be against them. This is what the Greens are going to have to put up with now, though, isn't it? They're going to have to go out and face up for a lot of the government policies that they themselves have to bite their tongue over.
Yeah, it's a kind of a cold dose of reality, I think, and it'll take a bit of getting used to for any party doing this. I mean, we know what brings the SNP and the Greens together, but this week, we, like you said, we're starting to see what keeps them apart as well. For example, I mean, we looked at the transport projects such as the A96 upgrade in Aberdeenshire. We know about that one. We know that the SNP has already got a fairly fraught job on its hands trying to get to grips with the Freeport idea, which is a UK government initiative. It's a bit of a technical jargon black hole, but they basically establish special tax status around a harbour or an airport, in this case probably a harbour like Aberdeen. It's apparently good for business, it gives special tax status, it keeps goods flowing. The SNP had to be sort of really cajoled on board with that one. They didn't like it at all to start with, and now it's creeping along at snail's pace, but the Greens don't like it at all. So we're already at the point, as we reported earlier this year, that the UK government are threatening to essentially just undermine devolution by saying, you know, I've had enough of this, we'll just go and do the Freeports ourselves. But having got the SNP this close, to find that they now have two ministers in the negotiating team who don't like it at all, it's like back to the drawing board. Do the Greens now just find a way of saying, well, we agree to disagree, and let it happen, in which case, you know, what's the point of having their sort of principled stance on it? Or do they say, well, actually, we can't win this one? And then, you know, how does the coalition or agreement or whatever kind of words you want to use, how does it continue through that kind of a you can't just agree to disagree on everything. There has to be a collective government view. And otherwise, people, voters as well, will just sort of lose track of what the point of it all was. What was the point of having a Green element in a government if their plans just get pushed to the side when the SNP need to do something? So yeah, it's going to be a tough readjustment. COVID passports is one of them. We'll see what else we can, in the days ahead, we're bound to see each policy that gets brought up again. We're going to have to think, well, what does this mean for the Green element?
And just briefly on COVID passports, because they are going to have a vote in Parliament next Tuesday on it. Mm-hmm. Rachel, the Lib Dems have come out and said that they are strongly against them. They believe them illiberal, even though they do agree that the vaccines is the way that we will get out of the pandemic. Can you see that? What do you think the feeling is going to be towards vaccine passports? We've covered it quite a lot regarding how our digital passport for getting overseas or getting abroad for work isn't particularly good. But do you personally think that having a proof of vaccination is the way forward.
Yeah, the Lib Dems have said that they're always going to oppose this. The new leader, Alex Cole-Hamilton, he's called them medical ID cards. He says that people shouldn't have to share their medical records to get certain freedoms. We must remember, though, that if this is approved, it is limited the situations where you would need a vaccine passport. We're talking about nightclubs, outdoor events of more than 4,000 people, indoor events of more than 500, and events of over 10,000. So for a lot of people, it will not have as big an impact as we maybe think in the first look. I know myself, for example, I'm not attending events of over 10,000 people every day. And she was quite clear, Nicola Sturgeon was quite clear that essential things such as public transport, attending hospitals, those sort of things will not need a vaccine passport. And she also said that those who genuinely have reasons for not getting a vaccine will also be exempt from this as well. So as much as it will cause controversy, people will be against this, it will have a limited impact, I think, on a lot of people. There will be some people who will have more impact than others, but it is very limited, the events that this is going to be needed for.
And Andy, as a big first stand for Alex Cole-Hamilton in his new role as Scottish Lib Dem leader, do you think this is a good old-fashioned liberal sticking point that's worth him sticking his neck out over?
Yeah, I mean, he became leader on the day that the SNP and Greens announced their programme to work together. So he's always going to find himself up against bigger parties. He's in a group of four MSPs now, so I suppose it does suit him to have a very clear message on anything at the moment. So where other parties might be a little bit tying themselves in knots about whether or not they all agree on the same thing, it's quite easy for a group of four to come to a collective agreement, and it's quite easy for Alec Cole-Hamilton to just say something and stick to it. The Liberals across the UK have always had a very clear view on things like ID cards. So I guess it does help people to understand a bit more where the different views are in Parliament at the moment. So it's a helpful thing for him at this stage.
Now, it just so happens to be our 100th ever episode of The Stooshy, and we thought we would bring in a special guest. The special guest couldn't join us this week, so we went to David Clegg, who just so happens to have a new book out. David, I think we'll get you to introduce the book, what it is about, and welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back. It's amazing 100 episodes have been done since we launched that first one rather quickly in response to the 2019 election.
I know, it's horrible. I think there's been more than 100 weeks since then.
It feels like 100 years, to be honest, Paul, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So, Break Up, the book that you have co-written with Times journalist Kieran Andrews, former Courier man as well, of course. Talk us a bit through about the book and why you thought it needed to be published right now.
Yeah, so it's called Break Up, Why Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon Went to War. And it is about the origins of the feud between Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, how that 30-year friendship and political partnership, which revolutionised the SNP, completely transformed them from a fringe party to the natural party of government in Scotland, brought the country to within a few hundred thousand votes of independence, and, you know, terrified the British establishment. How that relationship, which had been so long-standing and so strong and so disciplined, how it broke down in response to the sexual harassment allegations that were raised about Alex Salmond in 2018. So the book came about really as a story that I had worked on in a previous life. I had been involved in the original story of the complaints being made against Alex Salmond, which happened in the aftermath of the Harvey Weinstein scandal and the Me Too movement and that type of social change that these what were by that stage. They were, you know, dated back 4 years, even whenever they were being raised at that point. And how that moment, how that issue led to the unravelling of the relationship between Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond. The reason why we decided that the book was required, or why it was a story that needed told properly, was really during the parliamentary committee inquiry, which happened earlier in the year, as you'll remember. So the timeline here was that the allegations were made early 2018. There was a Scottish government investigation into them, which was botched. Salmond took the government that he used to lead to the Court of Session to have that investigation struck down. That was found to be unlawful, unfair, and tainted by apparent bias. Subsequently, there was the criminal trial, of which we're all aware he was acquitted of all charges and left the court without a stain on his character. And it kind of, it felt in a way at that point that, you know, this the actual story had finished, and it was really just the implications or the consequences of it, you know, what would happen next. But Kieran and I, so Kieran Andrews, he's the, as you mentioned, he's the Scottish political editor of The Times. He is a former political editor of The Courier, long-term colleague and friend of mine, although we never really worked together. Our paths crossed briefly when we were both on The Courier at the same time, but we were just discussing that how the parliamentary inquiry had been very unsatisfactory. It was a very politically motivated inquiry. It didn't really get to the heart of the issues that we thought were important. It was very much just focused from the opposition perspective and effectively trying to damage Nicola Sturgeon, as it was taking place in the spectre of that election in May. This was happening February, March, April, and the election was rapidly approaching. So we felt there was, like, not only unresolved questions and parts of the story that hadn't really been brought properly to public attention, but also there was a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there. This, I think, you know, this, there's an element of which this whole saga has been what some people would call a disinformation event, in that, you know, there is absolute nonsense on the internet about this, and it is believed and shared quite widely. So we felt there was a few. We didn't get into it lightly either, which is the interesting thing. This is not a fun experience. Writing about these issues in Scottish politics is not something you do if you're up for a laugh. And in some ways, both of us undertook it with a bit of foreboding, because we both, you know, were quite comfortable in our jobs and what we were doing. And but we felt that we were kind of uniquely positioned to tell that story, because we had worked in the political journalism world for so long. We had the sources to do it. So between us, I think we've interviewed more than 100 people for this book. And really, I think at the end of the day, what we wanted to do is that there was two women who came forward to the Scottish government in early 2018 and shared their concerns about the way Alex Salmond had behaved towards them when he was in government. And these women have been failed by almost every institution in the country now. The Scottish government hadn't done anything about their concerns at the time, and when they brought them back to them in this slightly new, transformed climate in the wake of Me Too, they began an investigation which they cocked up unbelievably. So these complaints are still officially on the books of the Scottish government, which is one thing I think that, you know, most the public maybe don't realise particularly, that Alex Salmond was cleared in court of criminal charges, but the actual complaints about sexual harassment in the workplace that he faced have never really been adjudicated on. The Court of Session ruled that the investigation had been flawed because it was procedurally unfair. They just rejected the investigation. They didn't make any judgment on the actual allegations. They could still be reinvestigated by the Scottish government tomorrow if they were so minded. So they were failed by that. Then they were pushed into a court process, which they had actually, we now know, been very reluctant to get involved in a criminal process. They had made sexual harassment in the workplace allegations, and the Scottish government, Permanent Secretary Leslie Evans, reported this to the police against their will, effectively. So they were pushed into a criminal process, which was, of course, very traumatic for everyone involved, I suppose. And then in the committee, this parliamentary committee then picks this stuff up subsequently. And rather than trying to examine the culture at the heart of the government, why the civil service had failed to deal with these issues, it became an attempt to ambush Nicola Sturgeon. It had no real interest in getting to the bottom of any truth. It just had the interest in pursuing potential attack lines on Nicola Sturgeon. I think that's most vividly illustrated by the way that the motivation of that committee changed. So when this committee was initially set up prior to Alex Salmond being charged in January 2019, and its remit was to investigate what had went wrong, and the people on that committee at that point thought they were going to be investigating whether Nicola Sturgeon had helped Alex Salmond cover up improper behaviour. The verdict in the court case and the fact that Alex Salmond was clearly furious with Nicola Sturgeon for refusing to intervene in the government procedure meant that that was not possible. So instead, what the parliamentary committee began to do was try to see if there was any evidence or even any dirt that could be thrown at Nicola Sturgeon in regards to of this outlandish conspiracy which had grown legs on the internet, that she had been involved in a massive criminal conspiracy which had involved, you know, the police, the Crown Office, the civil service, pretty much the entire establishment of Scotland to imprison Alex Salmond falsely by fictionalising these claims. So we spent a great deal of time dealing with that rather than dealing with the, you know, the more basic points about, well, if women in politics working in these positions come forward with concerns about the most powerful man in the country, how the hell do you deal with it? What do you do in those circumstances? How do you do that whenever that is such a tricky, difficult situation, and quite clearly in the past Scotland has entirely failed to deal with it properly. Now, I'm not suggesting by any means that the book is going to solve any of these issues, but we did feel that there was a public interest, and it would be a useful contribution to the debate to just do what our job is or what our skill set is, which is just to catalogue exactly what happened. We're not a parliamentary committee. We're not a court of law. We're just two journalists who asked some questions and wrote down what we found. But that is the essence of the book. And that was also a very long answer for what you
have. It was a very long answer. but I'm glad that you did it, because it means that we don't need any more explanations. Nobody. You did mention during that it was a pretty dark process to cover. I remember the trial, which was taking place just as the coronavirus was outbreaking. It was sapping to sit through and listen to, as any of these trials are. In terms of how, you know, the two women that made the complaints to the Scottish Government that sort of got everything rolling, do they feel that the changes have been made in Parliament and government that are within the Scottish establishment that would mean that this can't happen again?
So I don't want to speak for them in that way, but all I can do is point you to quotes of theirs that are on the record. The parliamentary committee did interview them in private or take evidence from them in private. They did then, I should say, leak a lot of that evidence very quickly to the media in a way that they shouldn't have done. But they did. The woman involved agreed for some of their comments to be published in the final report. And we end the book with one of the quotes, which is that they had came forward initially not for any desire to seek personal retribution, but because they wanted to share their experience so lessons could be learned for the future. And initially they had some hope that that might happen. If you remember, it was a very powerful social moment at the end of 2017 when it felt like there was going to be change. My personal view is it doesn't feel like that's the case anymore. And the analysis of one of the women that's quoted in the book was that that hadn't happened and it had been crushing. So, no, is my view, and their answer is on the record.
And David Clegg and Keir Andrews' book, The Breakup, is available. That's all we have time for this week. Thank you to Rachel, Andy, and of course David for joining us. In the meantime, please make sure to check out The Courier Online, The Press and Journal Online, and all of our other digital formats and physical paper formats. I've been Paul Malik. Thanks to you for listening in. Make sure you join us next week so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshy or follow Stooshy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.